This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Why, after 50 years, can you remember what you were doing when John F. Kennedy was assassinated? Or how come 40 years later, the memory of your first love lingers on? Sentimentality aside, there is science behind the persistence of your long-term memories. And new research shows a special class of protein, similar to the ones that actually cause diseases like mad cow and kuru, are apparently helping to maintain these memories. The lab of Nobel laureate Eric Kandel recently had four papers published in Neuron and Cell Reports on this topic. Dr. Kandel is with us. He's also director of the Zuckerman Mind Behavior Institute at Columbia University Medical Center. Always good to talk to you, Eric.
Ira, it's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about prions. What are they?
Prions, the term means protein infectious particles. And as you pointed out, these were first discovered in the course of studying a degenerative disease called Jakob-Creutzfeldt disease. And they were discovered by Stanley Prusner, who's a great clinician, molecular biologist. And he found that they had very interesting properties. Conventionally, one thinks of infectious particles as being made of DNA or RNA. He found for the first time that infectious particles can be a protein. And he found that they exist in two states, a soluble form in which they're inactive and an aggregated form in which they're active. And one doesn't know what is responsible for the conversion. It occurs spontaneously. When it moves into its aggregated form, it kills the cell. It's then released from the cell, taken up by other cells like an infectious particle, does harm in that cell, kills that next cell releases it, third cell takes it up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and ends up killing lots of cells. For example, we now know that this same mechanism also contributes to Alzheimer's disease and is responsible for killing large numbers of neurons in the brain. It contributes to Parkinson's disease. It contributes to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Huntington's disease. So it contributes to a number of degenerative diseases of the nervous system. This was originally Stan Prusner's idea, but of course he's enthusiastically brought many other people's interest in it. We made a discovery first in a snail and extended it to the mouse in these recent series of papers in which we found that memory has two steps, a turning on of long-term memory, growing new synaptic connections, which is how long-term memory is formed, and a second step, which maintains the memory. We found, first in the snail and then in mice, that that maintenance step is mediated by something that regulates the synthesis of proteins at the synapse. And that mechanism is a prion mechanism. The protein that is responsible for local protein synthesis consists in two states, a soluble form and an aggregated form. But the conversion does not occur spontaneously. It's mediated by a physiological signal critical for establishing long-term memory. And number two, once it's in its aggregated form, it does not do any damage to the cell. It has a functional purpose. It regulates the synthesis of proteins necessary to maintain the anatomical changes that mediate long-term memory. So when you remember something, you've grown new synapses, new anatomical connections in the brain. This is the mechanism that maintains that.
So you have to have these prions, these prions that don't cause disease, the second kind, to maintain the memory?
That's right. We call them functional prions.
Functional prions.
They're essential in snails and in mice, and now my colleague Cal 6C has shown in flies as well, for maintaining long-term memory. Homologous proteins exist in your brain and mine, but neither we nor anybody else has started to explore them yet, but obviously that needs to be done.
Wow. Is this something totally unexpected?
To me, it was extremely unexpected, and to have this at this particular phase, you know, I'm not as young as I look. I've been around the block a few times, so it's wonderful to have this at this point in my life.
Uh-huh. So does that mean if we give people prions somehow, and we could extend the memories or make memories better?
I'm not sure we can just do that, but there might be ways of enhancing aggregation And we have some clues for that. There's a mechanism called ubiquination, which enhances this process, just like there are mechanisms that take it apart. One of the papers deals with sumerylation, which is a disaggregation. So you can imagine a process like this, which is potentially very explosive, has to be highly regulated. Mm-hmm. And it is highly regulated.
You know, of course, people are going to wonder about neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Lou Gehrig's. Is prion regulation involved in that at all?
Yes, it's critically involved in that, in Alzheimer's disease. But it's a different form of prion. So it's a prion that kills cells. So my idea, for which there is no support, is that God did not create prions to kill cells. This probably was initially a beneficial mechanism, functional mechanism, and then a mutation occurred that caused it to become pathogenic, you know, as occurs with, you know, various kinds of things that lead to tumors. There's no evidence for this. I'm just throwing this out as an idea.
Can you research it? Can you try to find out if it's true or not?
Well, what we're doing is we're looking to see there must be other functional prions.
Right.
And we now have, and you know, I told the people in my lab that one example of a functional prion is a biological curiosity. Two examples is a functional principle, a biological principle. Let's find another example. And Joe Raymond in my lab was the one who recently has come up with an extremely interesting variant of this that is important in post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's quite likely that there are a number of different functional prions around that serve different purposes. And one point in evolutionary history, one or another of these went awry and gave rise to the first of what turned out to be a large family of pathogenic prions. I should indicate that these papers that you're referring to have been carried out by colleagues in my lab. Luana Carani was particularly important, and Luana Ferentini, Bettina Disraldi, Joe Stefan, so a number of people have been very, very important.
Could it be that the prions are active not just in the neurological systems of our bodies, but in other places as well, doing other things?
That's certainly possible. They haven't been discovered there as yet, but I would be surprised if they were not. Usually, when nature finds a good functional mechanism, it holds on to it. So this probably holds on to pathological mechanisms as well.
Wow. You know, in all the years we've been talking, this is something totally different.
This is new. It's really Cal6C in my lab first discovered this in aplysia almost a decade ago. But it's really Luca and Luana and Bettina that have pushed it recently in the mammalian brain.
So let me talk about you. Are you working on another book at all, Eric? You got a new book?
Yes, I'm glad you asked me. the last time we talked in a book on art and science.
Right.
And I spoke about, speaking of post-traumatic stress disorder, this book is about Vienna, but not about the Vienna that kicked me out, but a Vienna of 1900, which was sort of a golden age of Vienna. And I focused on three Viennese artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele, which have gotten a lot of attention for a lot of reasons recently, including the Neue Gallery, bought Bloch Bauer, this wonderful painting that Klimt did, in which Schoenberg was able to rescue from the Austrian Museum. It had been falsely claimed by them. So this was on figurative art, and I focused on portraiture. Now I'm writing on abstract art. I'm trying to make the point that C.P. Snow first called to people's attention. C.P. Snow said that humanists and scientists have very little to say to one another because they have different aims and different methods. And I quite disagree with that. And I feel that certain artists have, you know, very much a research approach, an investigative approach to art, and certain scientists have humanistic goals. Forgive me for using myself as an example, but learning and memory is a perfectly humanistic problem, and one doesn't just have to approach it philosophically, one can approach it empirically, and that's what I've done for the last 60 years.
Yeah.
But I also want to point out that artists can use investigative approach. And I use a number of artists that started off as figurative artists and then became abstract. And as they became abstract, and I'm speaking about people like de Kooning and Pollock and Rothko, they experimented to get to the simplification that they wanted, really a reductionist approach. Mm-hmm. So I point out similarities between art and science, and I give some insights as to how the beholder responds to abstract art.
And when is the book going to be out, Eric?
I hope to finish it certainly by September. Mm. I hope it'll be out a year from now. Columbia University Press is doing it. I'm extremely fond of Columbia, and I'm very pleased they're doing it. And they wanted to come out at the time that the Mind-Brain Behavior Institute, the Dorn Green Building, will open up, which is supposed to be in a year from September.
So when are you going to get a real job, Eric?
I'm looking for that, you know, but I like so much this hobby I've had for so many years that why should I work?
Which is easier, writing or doing your lab research?
Oh, well, they both complement each other. You have to realize I'm in a very privileged position at this point. I've got wonderful people in my lab.
And you're still a young guy.
Pardon?
You're still a young guy, too, so we can look
forward. What choice do I have?
Well, thank you, Eric, as always. Thank you very much. And this is fascinating, fascinating research. We're going to follow it along with you, okay? We'll be calling you back.
You follow this, and particularly follow the work of Luca, Bettina, and Luana, because they're going to explode with something very soon.
That's a look ahead. I'm glad to hear that.
Look ahead. We should talk again in 6 or 8 months from now.
All right.
Wonderful.
Thank you
for having me on the program.
Always. Mark. Eric Kandel, co-director of the Zuckerman Mind Behavior Institute at Columbia University Medical Center. We're going to take a break, and coming up, we're going to plot the ultimate science road trip. So get ready to go. Charge up your electric vehicle. We'll be back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For most people, I think a road trip means sun, the sky, the sea, the sand. And don't get me wrong, I like those things too. But if you've got a bit of geek in you like I do, your sightseeing becomes even more enjoyable when you can learn something about the science history of your destination. For example, you're headed to the Jersey Shore, right? Well, why not take a detour to the Horn Antenna, where scientists first detected cosmic microwave background radiation over there at Bell Labs and confirmed the Big Bang. Or you can take a break from I-25 to swing by New Mexico's Trinity Test Site just in time for its 70th anniversary next week. And my next guest has been to all of these places and many, many more. John Graham Cumming is a computer programmer and author of the Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive. He joins me from London to help us plot the ultimate geek road trip. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much.
Is that 128 significant? It's big in the world of geekdom, isn't it?
It certainly is. It's 2 multiplied by itself 7 times, and anyone who's familiar with binary would instantly say, aha, that's a joke for computer programmers.
Yeah, it just jumped out at me, you know, when I looked at it.
I'm sure it did.
How did you get the idea for this book?
I found myself working in Munich in Germany, and at a loose end, I asked the tourist office what I could do, and they suggested a number of things, and one of them was a visit to a very large museum called the Deutsches Museum. And I made this discovery of this fantastic science museum, which is actually, there's 3 parts to it. They have a whole bit dedicated to trains and another bit dedicated to planes. And I went back to my hotel room and thought, how could I not have known about this? I'm going to buy the book about geeky travel, and went on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it didn't exist. Wow. And I think with the arrogance of anybody who's written a book, I thought, I could probably write that.
Yeah. Well, we want to ask our listeners to join in. If you have a spot, a must-see spot for this itinerary, any itinerary, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. If you have a spot that is irresistible, please let us know. We also have a website. On our website, we have a map that we'll talk about later of spots to visit. So give us a call. Maybe we'll add it to it later. How did you pick the sites, John? What is your criteria for deciding? Because there's so many, right? that you could have put in the book?
Yes. I mean, I probably could have gone on to 256 places, which is the next power of two. But what I wanted to do was have things that were what I described as worth visiting. For example, in the US, Goddard very famously started a lot of the US space program and did lots of rocketry experiments. Unfortunately, where he did them is in the middle of a golf course, and there's just a little plaque saying, you know, he did it here. And that didn't hit my criteria. I mean, it's interesting, but it's not really a great day out. And so I wanted things where you could really enjoy the science. So it had to be something that was worth taking the time to visit.
Hmm. Yeah, and I remember years ago when I went to look at Lindbergh's site where he took off from to go to Europe. That's in the middle of a shopping center. So it was a little plaque
exactly.
on the wall. You know? let's kick off our road trip. Our first stop is off a back road in New Jersey. Tell us about that.
Well, so this is the Horn antenna, which is in a place called Holmdel in New Jersey, which is very near Bell Labs. And it's a very, very large, essentially a sort of satellite dish, although not a dish. It's a horn-shaped antenna that was originally used for a thing called Project Echo, which is before we had communication satellites. NASA did an experiment where they put an enormous balloon in space, which was metallized, and bounced radio signals off it. And that was this antenna was used for that and proved that we could do communications through space. And then it was used for radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it discovered the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Yeah, it's all by mistake, wasn't it? They thought there were bird droppings in there.
There were bird droppings in the antenna. One of the problems with listening for very faint signals from distant galaxies is that you must eliminate all sources of noise. So they had to do all sorts of extreme things like cool the radio down to close to absolute zero and then get rid of the pigeon droppings, which they thought were making this background they could hear. And, of course, that background, as they moved the antenna around, they realized it was everywhere in the sky, this background noise, which made them think actually it was coming from inside the antenna. But, of course, it wasn't. It was the remnants of the Big Bang giving us a signal.
You know, one thing that I really enjoyed about your book and actually slowed me down in going through it is that you, for every spot that you tell us to visit, there's a wonderful geeky explanation of something related to that spot. You know, you explain the electronics, or the historical stuff, the technology behind that spot. And it's just wonderful the way you write that. And I had to stop and read all of it because it was so interesting.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because that was half the fun of writing the book, was to sit down and say, okay, what really happened here? Do you understand it? And for some things, my background is mathematics. I really understood it, or computer science. But then when I got into biology, I was tearing my hair out and ended up emailing various professors around the world to get advice.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to our first call from... is it Katrina in Lynchburg, Virginia? Katrin? Are you there? Oh, well, maybe our phones are having a little bit problem with our phones. Let me try. Katrin, you there?
I am here.
Hey.
Hey.
I have found you. Go ahead.
Great. Oh, great to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'm a physics professor at Randolph College in Virginia, and we take our astronomy class, it's a class for non-majors, about 50 kids, to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in West Virginia. It's in Greenbank, and it's in that big national radio quiet zone. So there's no cell service. You can't even have a microwave in that area. And they get to basically be a radio astronomer for a night. They train them to use the 40-foot radio telescope. And it's just a great vacation spot. So I take my kid, and I take a bunch of other people and their kids, and it's just a wonderful science vacation.
Mm-hmm. Wow, good choice. Thanks for calling. Good choice, John.
That's actually in the book, funny enough. So that whole area is fascinating, as you say, because there's no cell phones and microwaves and things allowed. And it's also got the first radio telescope that a guy called Reber built in his backyard by himself before anyone was really doing radio astronomy. And eventually it was moved there. Absolutely fascinating place. And not very far away from there, there's a place called the Greenbrier, which is a very fancy hotel, which was actually where Congress was going to be stored underground if there was a nuclear war, essentially. And you can now visit the place where they were going to go.
Oh, speaking of the government, it's hard to believe that this next site even exists. It's the NSA Museum.
And it's open to the public, right? You don't have to sneak in to see it. So, now, admittedly, it is slightly outside the NSA. It's fairly close to the NSA headquarters. And it's called the National Cryptologic Museum. And it really covers the history of cryptography, of making codes and breaking them, up until some period in the Cold War, because, of course, a lot of what's done is secret, or at least it was secret, I guess, until Edward Snowden came along. And it's fascinating because you get to see the real equipment that was used. And I found it particularly fascinating because it's one of the few places in the world you can use a German Enigma machine from the Second World War, actually touch it and try it out.
It's a real one.
It's a real one, and they have it. And unfortunately, in other places, they tend to be behind glass and treated as things that you can't possibly touch. And there, I guess they don't get that many visitors, and so it's okay to touch it.
Wow, wow. I'm going to have to try that one out. Let's go to the phones. Catherine in San Luis Obispo. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello,
hey there.
John and Ira. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Great.
Good. I wanted to recommend as a location, if any of your listeners are going to Florence, Italy, there is a little museum of science there, which is fantastic. It's right around the corner from the Uffizi Museum, which we passed up. Everybody told us to go to the art museum, and instead we decided to go to the Museo di Scienza, is how it's pronounced in Italian. And they have history of medical science, history of optics, so much astronomy there, and the most beautiful instrumentation there as far as historical developments in Italy, particularly during the Renaissance period of scientific development. I highly recommend it. It's absolutely beautiful.
You know, I went to that place a few years ago, and you know what else they have there? Maybe you didn't see it. They have Galileo's middle finger in a glass jar.
Oh, my God.
The bones sticking out. Did you know that, John?
I've heard of that museum, and I've not visited, and now I have to go see it just for the middle finger.
Yeah, it's you just stumble across, but it is a great choice. Thanks for phoning that in, Catherine.
Great, thank you.
I don't think there's something like that in the States, John. That you can see
bits of dead bodies. I think there are.
Well, I mean you're right. There are the Mortar Museum, and there's the
The Mortar Museum is clearly a good one.
And there's also the one in Washington. I'm thinking the Walter Reed Army Medical Museum.
Absolutely.
Yeah, give us. You can do a sleepover in the next one. This is one I've always wanted to go visit, and that's the Titan Missile Museum out in Arizona.
That's right. It's a good way to get a sense of the Cold War in some ways, because it's a real missile silo, so you know, a great big concrete hole in the ground essentially, with a Titan II missile still in it, presumably with the warhead removed. And of course, you get to go down underground. And when I visited it, the visit was done by someone who had actually worked in a Titan missile silo as one of the commanders. And you get to see what it was like to sit down there for hours at a time waiting for someone to tell you to launch this thing. And as you say, they do offer sleepovers. So if you really want to take part in the sort of Cold War experience, you can sleep there at night.
This must be a chilling experience to sleep next to a missile.
a very, very dangerous missile as well, actually. The refueling, it was incredibly dangerous because they use what's called a hypergolic fuel, which means it just ignites all by itself. And refueling them was tremendously dangerous.
Yeah, well, it's not fueled now, is it?
I guess not.
All right. Let's go to the phones on our road trip. Let's go to George in Utah. Hi, George. Welcome to Science Friday. George.
Hello. Hello.
Hey there.
This is Ted.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to talk about a museum in London that houses John Harrison's chronometer, and also you could see the Greenwich line and walk on the line. They were both fascinating experiences.
Wow.
Yes, John. Those are wonderful. That's the Greenwich Observatory, which is both an observatory for the stars, of course, and has the zero line of longitude, and you can sort of step in the eastern and western hemispheres there. And as the caller says, there are the wonderful clocks that were used for essentially measuring longitude by measuring the difference in time between where you were and London.
Mm-hmm. There's also, if you're still out there in the Midwest, there's the experimental breeder reactor in Idaho. Tell us about
that. Yes. Right. So, I mean, I think a lot of people think of potatoes when they think about Idaho. But there's actually a great deal of nuclear history, particularly for nuclear power generation in Idaho. And there is this thing called EBR-1, which is near a little place called Arco in Idaho. And Arco has the claim to be the first city lit by nuclear power because of this reactor. Of course, the reactor's been decommissioned, but the really fascinating thing is that in the parking lot of this this essentially nuclear power station are two nuclear aircraft engines. And if you want to get a sense for the insanity of the Cold War, you have to imagine that the idea was we need bombers to be up in the sky for a long time because we might have to bomb the Soviets at any moment. And unfortunately, they need refueling. So, our solution is nuclear engines. And so two were built.
Yeah, I remember that. And they never got off the ground, right?
Well, yeah, for a couple of reasons. One is, of course, you have the danger of killing the crew with, this nuclear reactor, which is right there. Or you have to put so much lead around it, you need a ridiculously large aircraft and long runway.
Yeah, talking with John Grant Cumming, who is a computer programmer and author of The Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. We have a tweet coming in. Let's see. Clarissa says, the amazing dinosaur museum in Tucumcari, New Mexico, right off I-40 and run by Community College with a bronze foundry and well worth a stop.
Okay, I've got to do that then. That sounds great. I do love dinosaurs.
Well, there's so many places. One of the places you recommend is right across from our offices here in Manhattan, the Mossman Lock Collection.
Yes, that's a bit of a hidden gem in Manhattan because I think
just like us. People, I'm sorry.
I think more people know about your show than know about the Mossman Museum. The Mossman Museum is a collection of locks, and the logic of it is, why are there locks in the middle of Manhattan? Because, of course, at one point you had physical money that you needed to lock up in vaults in New York, and of course now we lock it all up with codes, but at one time, you needed very fancy things. And, of course, there was a very famous company called Yale, which made locks. And so this is a wonderful collection of these beautiful, in fact, locks used for vaults and safety deposit boxes and things like that. And it traces a little bit the history of lock making from the Egyptian period.
We actually have a little video of that place. We did a video of that a few years ago up on our website at sciencefriday.com/roadtrip. What place would you like to go to that you haven't gotten to, John?
Well, there's one place that is in the book that I didn't visit, which is, and you mentioned it, which is the Trinity site, which is the site of the first nuclear explosion. And at one point, it was closed to non-US citizens. I think that has changed, and unfortunately, I have not yet had a chance to go back. I would very much like to go there, particularly to see the fused sand, which is still there, which the explosion was so hot, of course, it fused the sand into this sort of Trinitite stuff.
You've got a few international destinations for us, including one in your native Britain.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was kind of tricky to think about all the different things there are in Britain. Of course, there's a great deal of interesting museums in London. When you think about them, great destinations are things like Bletchley Park, where of course all of the cryptographic work was done in the Second World War. But my sort of out of the way kind of crazy one is a thing called the Hovercraft Museum. And the reason I like this is I think as a British person, the hovercraft is the craziest thing we've ever invented, which is sort of a floating gigantic machine. And I think people don't realize, if they haven't been in Britain, that we used to use hovercraft to get to France, going across the Channel. And these gigantic machines, essentially powered by jet engines, the gas turbines, would hold a very large number of people and shoot you across the Channel. And the problem with hovercrafts is they follow the water. So if the water's flat, it's wonderful. If the water's not flat, they don't cut through it like a ship. They follow it, and it can be very, very uncomfortable. But the Hovercraft Museum is an amazing place to get a sense of everything from a one-man sit-on hovercraft to a 200-person one.
All right, we'll talk more about this with John Graham Cumming, author of The Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive. We're going to take a break, and we're going to get back to our Great American Geek Road Trip with some help from a computer scientist who's going to plot a trip for us through the States to a lot of these places. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. This hour, we're plotting the ultimate geek road trip, sharing must-see spots for science and tech lovers. And I must apologize for putting Idaho in the Midwest. Of course, we all know it's in the South. Of course, joking, of course. What's on your geek itinerary this summer? You can tell us by calling 844-724-8255. That's 844-SciTalk. My guest is John Graham Cumming, author of The Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive. And John, you also have a few sneaky suggestions. If you have a loved one who doesn't like science, you know, how do you get them going? You don't tell them you're going to take them to a science museum, do you?
Well, I mean, that would be the honest thing to do. But if you can't manage that, there are some places where you can sort of happen upon science. In the UK, there's a lovely sort of botanic garden run by the University of Manchester, just outside of Manchester. And it's a lovely, quiet location. And one of the things about quiet locations is they are good places for radio telescopes. And so you can go for a walk in the country and happen upon one of the most famous radio telescopes in the world called Jodrell Bank.
Oh, look, look at that. Happens to be here, you know?
Absolutely.
Can we stop in for a few hours?
Exactly. For a tour.
For a quick tour. I want to bring on another guest. Earlier this week, we asked our fans on social media to play Science Travel Agent, and boy, you sent us your geeky destinations, and now we put them into an itinerary. And we aren't just doing this in any way. We're doing this in a very geeky way. So let me explain. Let me bring on another voice into the conversation. Randall Olson is a computer scientist and postdoctoral researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. And he helped us optimize. We had to optimize our road trip and find the shortest distance between all of these sites. Randall, welcome. How did you do that?
Hey, Ira. Happy to be on here.
Thank you.
Yeah, so as far as how I made this trip, I used a fairly well-known solution. I mean, this is sort of a known problem in computer science called the traveling salesman problem, where we're trying to hit as many points as we can, you know, various cities across the U.S. and trying to find the shortest path possible. And so how I did that is I pulled out a trick from sort of my research tool belt called optimization.
And the traveling salesman problem was basically, as you say, it's an old one. It's a salesman who goes on the road. What's the shortest distance, right? The shortest time he can travel between many cities. But it takes a lot of computing power now to do, because you had 26 destinations.
Yeah, exactly. It can get really complicated if you want to, you know, guarantee yourself that you found the absolute shortest path between all these cities, because, you know, you'll start with one city and then that'll leave you, say, 25 others, and then you have to go and explore all those other variations. You know, you pick another city, there's 24 more that you can explore. There's just, you know, an explosively large number of ways you can potentially visit these cities. And so that's why it's been sort of a nagging problem in computer science for a very long time.
So you broke it down and made it a bit easier.
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, I used this tool called optimization, which basically says, you know, we're going to throw the idea of let's say we're okay with not finding the absolute best path. Let's say we'll just be happy with, you know, a good enough path, because otherwise we may find ourselves, you know, spending thousands of years trying to find the best path. So let's get something that's actionable now. So this optimization tool basically starts with a random road trip. So I took all the stops, and I just kind of had a trip that goes randomly, zigzags all across the U.S. And then I had the optimization tool sort of tinker with it. So it would change the order of the cities, you know, maybe put the stops in Seattle right next to each other. That would make sense, things like that. And then if it finds, just by chance, a better one, it'll stick with it and keep building on that one.
Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to see this trip and you'd like to take the trip, it's no reason why you couldn't. It goes all through the whole country. It's at sciencefriday.com/roadtrip. How long would it take to go to all these cities, Randall?
Well, I mean, assuming 7 days, but that's assuming that you're driving straight driving the whole way. So basically saying you're inhuman, you don't need to stop for a break, you don't need to stop for food or going to the bathroom, or even stopping to enjoy the sights. So I don't recommend driving in 7 days, but there are some people that are into that.
And you hit all the big high spots. Well, not all of them, because there's so many there, but some pretty good ones.
Yeah, the viewers definitely added in some great suggestions for this trip. And I'm actually really excited to take a look. I actually just ordered this book we're talking about to try to map out what a trip like to all these spots would look like.
Yeah, John Graham Cumming is here with us. He's also author of the Greek Atlas. John, after you published the Greek Atlas, what was the site you get most grief for leaving out?
For leaving out? Well, that's a hard question because, I mean, everyone's got their bit of science they really love, right? So they'll say, "What you didn't do enough biology, or you didn't do enough about geology." So it's kind of hard. I don't think there's one particular place. The biggest demand is for a volume two, and that's the hard thing. And the hard thing there is figuring out what the next 128 are.
Yeah, maybe Antarctica somewhere in there.
Well, I have the Arctic, of course, is in there for the magnetic North Pole. That's probably the most inaccessible place in the book.
Yeah, a little chilly. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Ben in Tallahassee. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had fond memories as a kid growing up going to the Tallahassee Magnetic Lab that holds some of the country's, if not world's, strongest magnetics, and had a fascinating trip there. A bit of it went over my head being so young, but I remember a really fun demonstration with liquid nitrogen. They shattered a flower right in front of us and had a great time that I think would be a great stop for anyone's scientific trip.
Yeah, it's yeah, I can see how you would be attracted to it. Sorry.
Just be careful with your credit cards and cell phones, I guess.
Thanks for that recommendation, because, yeah, that's a very famous lab, John, isn't it?
It's very famous, and, you know, who can resist magnets? They're basically magic. I don't think they're even science, are they?
Right. And any recommendations for people traveling with kids? Because everybody jumps in the car.
Well, there's one rather nice one in New York State, in Ithaca. In the center of Ithaca, there is a thing called the Sagan Planet Walk. And what it is it's all of the planets of our solar system and the sun laid out as a scale model throughout Ithaca. So you can sort of do this walk, and you start at the sun, and then you'll find yourself at Mercury and Venus and so on, with the correct distances between them. So you get a sense for just how far away Saturn and Jupiter are, for example. And along the way, you pass through the asteroid belt, because that, of course, is there. And what they've done is they've taken a very large meteorite, genuine meteorite, and embedded it in the sidewalk. And so you can actually sit on it or touch it and see what one of these asteroids or at least a piece would be like.
Wow, that's terrific. Randall, you added your own site to our road trip. Why did you add it, and what did you add?
Well, I added it for a couple of reasons. So when I was looking at the road trip there, I noticed that Florida was fairly bare. And I actually grew up in Florida, so I was like, hey, we have to have a, you know, at least one stop in there, so it's representative. And so I picked the Kennedy Space Center over there, because that was definitely one of my favorite spots to go as a kid. I've been a huge, you know, space geek my whole life. And so there's just some really neat things to see there, especially Space Shuttle Atlantis, which was the last of the space shuttle program to be up in space. So I think that's a really neat spot to hit.
Yeah, and we were in Huntsville, in his wonderful center in Huntsville also.
Absolutely, yeah.
For space geeky stuff. Let's go to Denise in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Denise. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I can't wait for Fridays. This is a museum that we literally stumbled upon by accident many years ago. It's the American International Rattlesnake Museum in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We were there. I was wearing contact lenses at the time. There was a terrible sandstorm, and I couldn't see. And I said to my husband, just get me somewhere where I can wash out my eyes. And I took his arm, and he takes me into this place. Doesn't tell me what we're in. I hear him talk to a man. He takes me to the back. There's a sink. I bend over. I put on the water. I wash out my eyes. I open my eyes, and I look down, and next to me is this huge bucket of shedded snake skins. And I said, oh my gosh, what are we, where are we? And my husband says, look, we're in a rattlesnake museum. And it was very cool.
I don't know how to top that. I don't know how to top that, you know?
I think you asked earlier, can you name some museums that kids would like? Kids would love that.
It sounds fantastic.
All right. Well, we've run out of time, but I can't think of a better way to end this segment. Thank you, Denise. You know, when you said you stumbled into a rattlesnake museum, I was a little worried, but see, it all turned out okay for you.
It turned out great. It was a highlight of our trip.
All right. Thank you. And then I hope everybody has a great trip this summer, and maybe they'll be able to follow the route that we've got planned out for you. For Randall Olson, put it up there on our website. Randall is a computer scientist and postdoctoral researcher at the University of Pennsylvania in Philly. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Randall.
Thanks, Ira.
John Graham Cumming is a computer programmer and author of The Geek Atlas. It's a great, great book. I highly recommend, especially the stories that you tell in it, John. Thanks for writing and for being a guest on our show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
And as I say, you can check out Randall's Optimized Science Road Trip. Share your destinations at sciencefriday.com/roadtrip. Up next, supermassive black holes. Like their name suggests, they're gigantic, millions, maybe even billions of times bigger than the sun, and they gobble up everything that crosses their path. But for something so big, these supersized black holes are really good at hiding from telescopes. It's like a game of hide-and-seek for astronomers. But they can't hide forever. Writing in the Astrophysical Journal, researchers now report finding five new supermassive black holes. How did they do it? George Lansbury is the lead author on those papers. He's also a postgraduate student at the Center for Extragalactic Astronomy at Durham University in Durham, England. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. It seems like with something so huge, they'd be pretty easy to find. Why were they so elusive?
Yeah, that's right. We do see these supermassive black holes gobbling up the material around them, releasing large amounts of light, which we can see. But we think that there's a more numerous population of hidden black holes out there, which we can't see. And why can't we see them? So we think that there's these cocoons of gas and dust which surround these supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies, which hide them from our view.
So have we underestimated then the number of giant black holes out there?
Possibly, yes. But there are some theories which predict that these hidden black holes are out there at the centers of distant galaxies in very large numbers. So we're really interested in trying to hunt for these things and identify them.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with George Lansbury. So there could be millions, possibly millions more of them?
Yeah, that's right. So with New Star, we've this new NASA X-ray telescope, which sees the universe in X-rays. It's got X-ray vision, in a sense. We've been able to identify five of these hidden black holes. But as you said, there may be millions more out there.
Is there one in the center of our galaxy?
Yeah, that's right. So this brings this kind of research closer to home. Right at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, there's a supermassive black hole lurking there. It's different to these bright black, supermassive black holes we've been talking about in distant galaxies. Our black hole seems very weedy. It's not doing very much. It's not actively gobbling up its surroundings, which makes it less bright.
But it makes it good for us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what makes some super black holes very hungry and others not so hungry?
Well, it's really about the galaxy within which they live. For some black holes, there's material falling onto them, which they feed on, and as a result, they become very bright. As this material falls towards the black holes, it loses energy, and this energy is radiated as light, which we can see. But then, like our black hole, there just doesn't seem to be much material falling onto it at the moment.
Is there a limit on just how big these supermassive black holes can get?
That's an interesting question. We see very small black holes dotted throughout our galaxy and these supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies, which are millions of times larger. But recently, there's been discoveries of ultra-massive black holes, which may be up to tens of billions times the mass of our sun. And who knows, we may discover even larger black holes.
So now that you've found five, I imagine you're hunting for some more.
That's right. So with these five, we've only explored a very small volume of the universe thus far. And when we extrapolate these results across the whole universe, across the whole night sky, then we expect that there should be millions more of these things. So the next stage is to go out and find more.
Not all of these supermassive black holes are hidden. Why are some hidden and others not hidden?
So that's a very interesting question. And hopefully this is something we can learn more about from taking a closer look at the data that we've been taking with the New Star Telescope.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
George Lansbury is a postgraduate student at the Center for Extragalactic Astronomy at Durham University in Durham, England. BJ Liederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. You know, we talk a lot about dinosaurs on this show, but do you know where the word came from? Dinosaur. You can read about its origins in our latest installment of Science Diction. That's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com/dinosaurdiction. And you can find out about the feud between Charles Darwin and the man who named the dinos, Sir Richard Owen. Juicy stuff up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, all kinds of educational materials up there. We hope you'll enjoy it all week long. And if you like us, go to our website. And also get involved in our subscriptions there. Also go to Facebook if you like us. Like us on Facebook. And we carry out a discussion all week long on Facebook and at Twitter @SciFry. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.